back to the bin.
Oh, you wouldn't want to see what happens when you say it three times.
Yeah, spinning around, there's vomit. It's a whole thing. Yeah.
I mean, there's people that pay good money.
It's good to see you again, Ron, and it's good to see you for the first time, Carl.
Nice to see you too, Paul.
Good to be with you guys today.
So, first question I have for you, and this is by far the most important thing I'm going to ask the whole time, is I've heard it pronounced both ways. Is it Kessel or Kiesel?
It's, for my side of the family, Kiesel. I guess a few generations back, there was a religious schism. And there's the Kessels and the Kiesels. And I'm one of the Kiesels. But, you know, really, I've had this happen my whole life, so I don't get upset. It's not like I go, damn you, Paul! Get it correct!
No. Just think of Van Diesel and Kiesel.
We're often confused. We're often confused.
Yes. I know that Carl is often confused. I don't know why Carl is often
But
confused.
Your side of the family has gone with the Kessel pronunciation.
Kiesel.
Oh, no, they've gone with Kiesel. See, I already got it mixed up. See, this is why it's important.
It's okay. I mean, Diesel is what kids called me in elementary school to make fun of me. Hey, Kiesel.
Everybody had one of those, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got all, with the... I still to this day am bothered when they spell my name, because my name is Spataro, and when they spell it S-P-I-T, because it's S-P-A-T. And it just, I don't know, because kids used to make fun of, oh, spit, you know.
Yeah,
it's really crazy, the things that will bother you when you're a kid, and then it carries over to adulthood.
But it's anyway. uncanny how good the other kids are at figuring out what it is that's going to bother you. You know, when we're young, we're really good at sort of spotting the chinks in everybody else's armor and figuring out what's going to push their buttons. I was oblivious to all that. But
I was just going to say, so you were a bully, Ron.
No, but I'm not a bully, but I mean, just there were kids that would just tease you, even your friends. They would just say, this is the thing, this is the wound we can pick at, you know? As I understand it, in some cases, this is, it's kind of like a good thing. It's like when you're in a wolf pack or whatever like that, the wolves will find out one of their pack mates, if they have a weak spot, they will keep working at it to toughen that person up. I've heard it often said that this is true for dads. Dads tend to tease their kids, whereas moms tend to nurture. This is obviously completely just, absolutely speaking broadest strokes. There are exceptions to this rule all the time, but both of those functions are necessary. A kid needs to feel safe and welcome, but at the same time, they also sort of need to be toughened up a little bit for the world,
Dealing with my kids, I tease them. I wouldn't say mercilessly, but it happens. You know, something happens and I'll just kind of poke them a little bit. And I think part of that is just teaching them to recognize that. Between being really threatened and being teased.
Sometimes I would just flat out lie to my kids about something, some basic thing in life, just so they could learn to detect when a false, if I say something that's obviously stupidly wrong, even something that even a little kid would sort of instantly pick up on.
You do that often, still to this day, Ron.
So I have lied lately about everything. It's true.
See, my biggest lie to my children is whenever they would do something kind of dopey and I would catch them on it, and they'd say, well, how did you know? I had to act as if I was omniscient. That was my biggest lie. I just made it look like I knew everything at all times, and there was no way they were ever getting away with anything, just to try and keep them from, keep them on edge that if they were doing something stupid. But if either of you have older siblings, then you probably know what it's like to be teased mercilessly.
Yeah, I had an older brother. Yeah, so I got that.
I am the youngest of four.
Oh, really? Oh.
And the brother closest in age to me, the two older ones were always good to me. The brother closest in age to me would tease me to no end. He was out and out mean. I thought he was a demon from hell. And it turns out that now he's a deacon at his local church. So well, it shows you what I knew.
That's quite a conversion. Yeah.
Anyway, let me throw this in because I'm already enjoying the conversation, but I might as well have it be a part of the episode. I'm probably going to leave it all in there anyway. So hello, everybody. This is Back to the Bins, and I'm Paul Spitaro. And I am very happy today to be joined by Ron Randall and Carl Kiesel. Listeners of the show might know Ron from his prior appearances on here and on Is It Jaws? So Ron has been a friend of the show to this point. Carl and I have corresponded through Facebook, which I don't even know how much of that you remember, and I'm going to touch on it. And of late, we've been trying to figure out a date when we could all talk, and it's just gone on and on and on to find a good day, and today is the day. And I'm really happy to talk to you two gents. So if you remember, Carl, and you very well may not, on this show, we did a, for us, deep dive into your Patriot miniseries. Mm-hmm. And after we concluded it and it aired, I sent you a link to it and said, hey, you might want to listen to this and let me know what you think. And we were effusive in our praise. We loved it. So your response was, who wouldn't like this? No, everybody would like to hear how their work is great. And then we talked then about, I mean, this has got to be, I would say, at least 7 years ago, maybe closer to 10. And we talked then about, oh, maybe you'll come on the show and we'll talk. And you were good. You said, well, this is the time I watch my kids and this is the time I'm available. And somehow it just never worked out. Yeah. So it was, I'll take the total hit on it not working out. But I'm glad that we get the chance to talk today. So the first thing I'm going to throw out to you guys, because I know you both do it, is Kickstarter stuff. What do you got in the hatch right now? And keep in mind that I kind of record in advance. This is probably going to see the light of day in late May, early June.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know what you're going to have brewing at that point?
Why don't you go, Ron?
I will late May, early June. So right now, as we record this in April, we're in April.
Mid-April.
Late April. Yeah, I'm in the middle steps of fulfilling my last Kickstarter. My last Kickstarter ended in February. So now I'm going through the steps of getting the files prepped and ready to go to the printer and that sort of stuff. And at the same time, in the back of my mind, I'm doing the planning for my next book. So to make a long story short, I don't have anything that's going to be coming up probably until early 2027 as far as launching another Kickstarter. I have a policy that is, a lot of it's due to just luck, that my policy is I will launch a Kickstarter when the book is done, you know. Many Kickstarters, for very, you know, practical financial reasons, people will run the Kickstarter to make the funds that will let them be able to afford to generate the book. I do it the opposite way around. I get the book done first, and then I run the Kickstarter to fund it and all that stuff. So that's the part of the process I'm in right now.
That's become easier. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I suspect that's become easier because you've had enough Kickstarter projects that you know it's going to get funded. You know you're not working for free, and then you get it funded and send it out. Makes sense to me. Tell me if I'm wrong.
That's part of it, but also I would just the way that circumstances worked out. I was taking an existing project I was working with Dark Horse as I call them my publishing partner when I created Trekker. So I was doing work for them, and I was posting pages one per week to a Trekker comic website that I have. And I was generating backlog of material there, waiting for Dark Horse to be able to get Trekker back on its publishing schedule. So finally, I just went to Kickstarter because I just got I was waiting too long for Dark Horse to be able to get more traction on their schedule. There was too long a gap between times books were coming out. So the result was I felt, well, I needed to go to take on the publishing myself to try to get it on a schedule that worked better. And the other result was that I, because of it taking a while to get the books out from Dark Horse, I was getting this backlog of pages done for Trekkers. So I had an issue ready to go when I launched the campaign for it. And that's a luxury, I'd say, that most creators don't have. You don't just have a 100-page, story done in your back pocket, just waiting to get it printed. But I kind of did. So I had some circumstances or conditions that a lot of creators don't get to enjoy having, and it turns out that's a really good selling point if you can do that, because when you launch it, most people that are back to Kickstarter have had the experience of having one or two of those where it takes the creator, for any number of reasons, a long time to get the book out, and if you've got the book more or less done before you launch the campaign, there are just fewer things that can get in the way. There are fewer possible complications that can come up. So I've been able to use that as a sort of a selling point when I run the campaign. I can say the book is like done or like 90% done, I always have a backup story that I don't draw until the campaign is run, because in that backup story I can draw some of the backers into it and give them a page of original art from it. And that's a nice sort of high-end premium reward tier that's pretty popular usually. So, but anyway, most of the work is done. The main story is all done and colored and everything. It's ready to go pretty much. So that's a big advantage. That was a long answer to your question.
As someone who's backed some of your Kickstarters, and I backed the most recent ones, so I'm going to be waiting for you to send me my stuff. I'll tell you, as a purchaser, there is a level of joy that comes with every step up when you say we got enough people and we get to give you this add-on and this add-on and this add-on. I'm sure you build that in certain ones you expect to hit and certain ones you'll see. But I do think you are giving the purchasers a certain sense of satisfaction when they feel they're getting something that they weren't guaranteed from the beginning. So at least certainly that's the way I feel about it. When you tell me I'm getting an extra, I'm thrilled.
It's funny, that's something that I have to look at other creators like Carl, for instance, who I feel is, there are people that are much more creative at coming up with ideas for what those sort of the add-on rewards, the stretch goals, I guess. So I just pick Carl's brain. I steal from him mercilessly when it comes to how to, a lot of things about Kickstarters. So I'm gonna let Carl talk about this more.
Okay, well, and I'm going to ask Carl, and I'm going to tell you right off the bat, I have yet to back one of your Kickstarters, but I want to, because I've heard enough about Impossible Jones that I would like to kind of dive in. And it sounds like a real fun concept. It sounds like something, and I'll let you explain to the listeners what it's all about. And what I was going to just ask you is, as opposed to just joining in the next story when you're ready to come out, is there something, because, like, for example, with Carl, I bought the two volumes of Trekker that are inclusive of, like, pretty much everything. It's real easy.
Telephone books.
Yes.
Those are
and I love them. I've got the books and I've got the PDFs. I love them. It's funny because I use the PDFs to read them because I don't want to ruin the books by reading them, which is what they're made for. But it's a weird situation, I guess.
I understand.
But anyway, is there a similar thing for Impossible Jones to get in on the ground floor and kind of
always anytime I run a Kickstarter, I offer the backlog, the back stock, whatever you want to call it, of the Impossible Jones books, even the book I did with Tom Grummet, Section Zero. I always give people the option of getting as much as they want, and every time around, and Ron said this too, you get a dozen people, half a dozen people, sometimes more, sometimes less, and they buy everything. So obviously they've never bought from you before, or they liked it a lot when they did, and they just bought a lot more. There's always a way to just start from day one, you know, a lot of different ways. But I always offer that on the campaigns, yeah. So.
And I'm going to ask you about your next campaign, but the first question before I get to that, because I'm just worried about my own selfish needs, is I anticipate having the pleasure of meeting you two in person at HeroesCon in mid-June. Are you going to have something there for me to buy from you to prevent me needing to wait for a Kickstarter for it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think both Ron and I plan to have some stuff shipped out. I mean, it's far too heavy to bring on the airplane, but ship out some of the books. And yeah, I'll certainly have everything there, including the new Even Steven book. I'll have all my hardcover books there for sure. So you get the hardcover books and those collect together. I've done a series of smaller what you might call floppies, although some of them are 80 pages long. But those are all collected in the hardcovers. Really, the hardcover is the place to go. So. Of course, there's not really, like a real cheap way to sample things out, like an ash can or something. So, I mean, these things are 25, 30, 50 bucks. So, but it's everything.
I'm not flying down to North Carolina, booking a hotel room and paying for a 3-day pass to save money. So I expect to spend a little money while I'm there. I look forward to meeting him, shaking his hand, finally seeing him in person after whatever it is, the 6-7 times we've had a chance to speak. But I don't know that I'm going to purchase anything because I've already purchased a lot.
Save your money, spend it with me.
I think I'm going to give you the money that Ron wants. What have you got in the hopper right now?
Well, right now, I'm still sending out the last few Even Steven books. I've sent them all out, but there's some local pickups. I've got about 14 local pickups where I'm arranging to meet people and hand off their books. But the vast majority of those have been mailed out. There's some that have been damaged. I'm replacing them. Some that got lost. I'm replacing them. Anyways, so I'm doing that. And at the same time, speaking of Kickstarters that take forever to finish, I am finishing off a Kickstarter that was launched in 2019, so 7 years ago, called Section Zero 1959. It is a prequel to the Section Zero book. And Tom Grummet and I did it. And for various reasons, Tom had other assignments, COVID hit, we had some problems with our children, and things just kept getting delayed. But for most of this year, I've been able to focus on Section 059, and Tom has finished penciling it. I finished inking it. This morning, I was sending off the last batch of inks to the colorist, and then I sit down and format all this stuff for lettering, and it probably won't be done by Heroes. Later in the year, I'm going to Terrificon, and the book probably won't be printed by then, but I'm hoping it'll be done and at the printer by the time of Terrificon.
I'm repeatedly trying to get my wife to go to Terrificon because it's at a casino and she's not a big gambler, but I think she'd have fun there. And it gives her something to do while I'm actually in the con. We'll see if I make it to that one as well. That's not that far. I'm in Long Island, so Terrificon.
Oh, yeah, that's really close. You can walk there.
It's about 2.5 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, so you can always come by here for a cup of coffee if you want.
That's very, very generous. But we do already have plans. My sister and her daughter both just moved to Rhode Island. So I found out just yesterday the plane where the airport in Rhode Island that we need to fly into to go to Terrificon is just 20 minutes away from my niece's house. So we plan to do some family visits after the show.
It's great when you can work it all in together. That is a cool thing. So after all of that, that was a big, long answer, and I'm still not sure that as of the time of HeroesCon, what do you have brewing that's going to be people can order? Is it just going to be in between?
I'm still – no, HeroesCon definitely I'm in between. I mean, as Section 059 ramps down as it finishes off. I will be starting another project, but it's a project on a write and pencil and ink myself, which I've done very rarely in my career. But I want to do something that's mine, that not just that I own, but that is, you know, that, as Terry Austin used to say, he wants to be able to justify every line on the page. That's kind of what I want to do. I want to have a book where everything in there, I can say, well, that's, I did that and it turned out great. And I did that and it turned out really bad, but I did it, you know, it's all me. And well,
that's what I was going to ask. Cause both of you have the background as artists, and to my eyes, very good artists. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But it seems like with most of the things I've dealt with Ron, it's very, very hands-on. He does the art, he does the writing, and you know, it's a little piece of Ron that I'm getting in the mail.
Yeah, absolutely.
With your stuff, it seems like you do pull in other people to do a lot of the art sometimes, whereas you'll ink it, or at least that's the impression I'm getting, but you have somebody else do the penciling. So I was curious, the two of you, like your opinions on how that works and, you know, how you feel about it.
Well, I mean, I was just, before I became a writer, I was an inker. I enjoy inking. And the blank page is very intimidating, at least it has been for me. And it's really, really, in my career, I got to work with some really great pencilers. I mean, George Perez, John Byrne, Terry Shugwarer, Tom Grummet. These people were really good and still are very good. And, you know, I've worked with Adam Hughes, people I can't hold a candle to. And so when you think about the people you're working, when you're working with people on that level, for me, it's been very intimidating to start on something my own that is not at that level. And it's taken me a long time to, I think, just improve enough where I think I'm not necessarily at their level, but I'm at a professional level, a level that doesn't embarrass me. You know what I mean? So I'm gonna take the plunge. You know, I mean, I actually was
that sounds just like what I've heard described as imposter syndrome, where you know you get praised for your work and you feel like you don't deserve it for some reason.
I've had imposter syndrome.
It's only a term I've only recently come in contact with, because I had some of that in my job, whatever it's worth. And I think if you're properly humble, you're almost going to have some of that no matter what. You're always going to feel, well, I did this and it's pretty good, but I could do better.
Yeah, it's the curse. It's the curse of any artist, I think. First of all, the imposter syndrome is endemic in art in general. I think certainly I know it. It's an intimate friend of mine. It's an intimate acquaintance of mine. I don't know if we're friends. The healthy and essential curse, I think, of any artist is you have to spend a good amount of your time thinking you're not good enough, because that's what drives you. It's like every time I do a drawing, I say, I failed there. Better luck next time. You know, that better luck next time is the essential thing that lets you get good enough to the point where you can be, as Carl just said, working at sort of like what we would call a professional level, where your work never drops below a certain point. But it's rare that you really sit down and you do something and said, this is the best drawing that's ever been done in the history of humankind.
No, that's true.
Doesn't happen, you know, or maybe very fleetingly you think I'm the best artist on the planet today or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the best I usually hit is I'll draw a panel and I'll go, that panel came out right, but the next panel didn't.
Better luck next time, right? I got maybe 70% of what I was after. You know, you're always swinging for the fence. You want to do the best job ever every single time. And you rarely, whatever I have in my brain, whether that's a specific image or even if it's just like a feeling, an impact that I want a panel to have, rarely do I get all of it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But I think that's the thing, you know, I would put a corollary to what Ron just said, because I think artists have to hold two nearly diametrically opposed opinions at the same time. They have to believe they are good enough for people to pay money for their work. Like, my stuff is good enough that you will want to buy this comic. Yeah. And at the same time, they have to say, I could do better. This is not as good as I mean, you constantly have, at least I do, constantly you're going back and forth between the two. You're saying, no, I'm good enough. Well, you know, really, I'm not good enough, but I really am good enough. You know, and that's That is the thing that, you know, just tears you apart.
Or I've never been good enough yet, but tomorrow I will be, you know.
So when I was a kid, and we're talking like, you know, late teens, early 20s, I thought, wrongly so, that I was good enough to be a professional artist, and I wanted to be in comic books, and I was drawing like crazy. And looking back, it's like, what the hell was I thinking that I had enough talent to do this?
I will tell you, the first time
it's amazing how much it takes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go
ahead. First time I sent samples to Marvel, I drew them on typing paper. I drew them in pencil on typing paper, and it was an Ant-Man story, and I sent it to Marvel, and I was probably like 14, 12, and I said, I'm ready for Marvel. I can't draw women in backgrounds, but otherwise, I'm your man. And they sent me a no prize, at least.
That's nice. That's nicer than what I got, because I sent samples to Marvel and DC, and I was probably about 20 at the time, and again, not nearly good enough, but I thought I was. And I got back a very nice letter from DC saying, you know, while we can't use you at this time, keep working at it, keep learning, and you know, maybe you'll get there, which was nice. It's encouraging. Mm-hmm. Marvel just basically sent me, you suck. We're not interested.
Yeah, so. I had to, when I was younger, I thought for sure I was, you know, as good as anybody they had working there. You know, I mean, I was so ignorant or so blind to my own. I mean, when you don't know that you don't know, sort of, you know. And so I was just drawing and, this is great. And I was so far. It's amazing to look back, because I was drawing like other kids. Well, I guess I was drawing like some of the other decent, you know, early teen, mid-teen, whatever age I was at there. And I, to this day, I don't know why I kept at it, whereas all of my other friends who used to, like, would draw together and show each other the superheroes were coming up with or whatever. And gradually, they all just drifted away and moved on to other interests. And I never did. So I just stuck at it long enough and, you know, had enough lucky breaks as well and met the right people at the right times and all that sort of stuff. So I don't know why it worked out for me and it didn't work out.
Well, yeah, I'm going to take that to the next step, because I know you both went to the Kubert School. If I understand correctly, one of you graduated, and the other one on to other things.
one dropped out.
Did you guys become friends back then? Were you in at the same time, or did you become friends after the fact?
We were friends. We knew each other. Ron was actually in the class that was on the second floor of the building, and I was in a class on the first floor. But there was, you know, I certainly knew who Ron was.
Yeah, we knew each other. I think my memory is that it was after. I think it was after. So we both went there for the first. We were in the second class of the Kubert School. We both were there the freshman year of that class. And then Carl left after the first year, and I stayed and graduated after the second year. And my memory is there was, like, sometime after that, there was a Tex Avery cartoon festival in the theater in Manhattan.
At the Thalia.
Huh?
At the Thalia, yeah, that was that Upper East, Upper West Side.
As I recall, I just went there probably with a couple friends, and I think we just bumped into you there. And I just remember striking up a conversation, and that's when it really clicked to me that we were, you know, that's to me when we sort of, you know, when I said, oh, we could be really good friends or something like that, you know, and we just stayed in touch. And I tried to get you when I was taking on the Arak comic book. I was penciling Arak, and we needed to get an inker, and I tried to get you and I think Rick Magyar, one of you guys, you were both really good inkers and talented artists and friends, and I was wondering, that'd be great to get a pal inking me on this book.
And then somehow you got him to move to Portland so that he could be near you.
Exactly. Well, that took a lot of money. Carl moved me to Portland.
Well, I don't know, nor do I have any interest in knowing your financial situation. But when I see the pictures of your beach and all of that, I just assume you have to be rich. Because whether you have it in money, just to live in that area, it's got to be tremendous. I mean, I'm very jealous when I see the pictures.
Well, thanks. Yeah, no, I don't have a lot of money. The number of cartoonists that have a lot of money are I'm sure there are a few, but I'm not in that echelon at all. But
Ron would have more money if he stopped buying Corvettes. You know,
that's true. Well, all that they add up. I have to no.
No, I mean, he's got one for every day of the week, I believe.
I don't have one of every for every day. I don't have one of anything for every day of the week. But we were lucky enough to get a very nice home on the beach. We both, my wife and I, had grown up in the Portland area, and each had, you know, as when we were families, when I was young, my family would take most of our vacations to the Oregon coast, and we both thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to live at the Oregon coast one day? And then we got to the point in time where we said, well, maybe it's possible, and we looked into it. And anyway, long story short, we're lucky to be here. We are not living a life of luxury as far as material possessions, but we're located where we want to be, and it's comfortable. So,
sometimes that's more important than the possessions, anyway.
Well, it is, yeah. And now you can just see that I've got a studio full of possessions, anyway. So, they're not like, you know, Corvettes or something like that, but I have, you know, books and records and just enough creature comforts that make it a cozy, comfortable studio for me to work in. And I can reach around and grab something for inspiration off the bookshelf anytime I want to, and something to listen to as I'm working too. So pretty good.
Well, it's one of the things I've honestly, in our interaction together, I mean, this is just for the sake of saying it, but I've enjoyed the fact that I don't feel that I need to talk to you or that I get a kick out of talking to you because you're a comic artist and writer, even though that's certainly a mutual interest. But what I've enjoyed is that we have other mutual interests that have allowed us to talk about things where I really feel like we're on a much, much more level playing field. We've talked about music, we've talked about movies, things like that. That, you know, there's not, well, you're the professional and I'm just a fan. Keeps me from feeling like just being a fanboy.
Well, and I don't know about, I assume Carl has similar experience with this that I do of, every once in a while I'll see somebody and explain what I do and they'll say, oh, you're famous, you know, and we ain't famous. We're not like the celebrities. I say in a very, very small world, there are people who know my name, you know, but it's not like I'm a Beatle.
we've talked about that on the show, and the version of it that we talked about is at New York Comic Con one year, walking around, and Neil Adams had his own area, and he was basically in New York Comic Con. He was a rock star, just like George Perez was in the day. You know, we were talking about it, and we said either one of them goes out to get a slice of pizza, and they stop being a rock star. You know, it's purely in the setting.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell you, until I worked on Superman, I don't even think, I'm sure my father didn't understand my career, because I was working on books no one had ever heard of, you know, and it wasn't until I was working on Superman that my dad saw this as like, oh my God, this is important, you know, important, right? But my other experience with fame is that in Portland, there are a series of very popular brew pubs run by the McMiniman brothers, okay? And they buy old places like a county poor farm or an old Elks Lodge. They fix them up and you can stay there overnight, and there's bars and there's restaurants, and they fill them with artwork depicting the history of the places. And my wife is one of their painters who paints these murals of the history of the places and does design work on the walls and stuff like that. So if we are out and about in town and someone asks, in Portland, if someone asks me what I do and I say I'm a comic artist, they go, oh, that's really cool. And then they ask Myrna, what do you do? And she goes, well, I'm one of the McMiniman's painters. They go, oh my God, you're one of the McMenamin screamers. And they get so excited. And it really kind of keeps you in your place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and my claim to fame artistically was I had drawn the, if you remember the four giveaway pictures with the white album of the Beatles, there was one of each of them close up of their faces, and I had sketched each one of them, and I gave them to somebody, and one day I walked into the local pizzeria, and the four of them were hanging on the wall.
Nice.
So I thought, now I'm famous.
That's it.
So, I was curious, and I had to look a little bit, do a little digging to say, okay, when did you two guys work together? What do I have that you worked together on? And what I landed on was Action Comics number 566.
So I really wanted
to ask you about I'm glad because I wanted to ask you about the experience of working together on that. And just the process, because neither of you was the writer of the book. Ron, you penciled it. Carl, you inked it, and I'm very curious as to how the process worked with getting the information, penciling the pages, and then sending them over, and you know, then inking them, and how that all worked. So I'm going to sit back and listen to you two gentlemen.
Okay,
tell me how this works.
Well, I'll start, I guess, because I was sort of there at the germination of the idea, because the writer was a guy named Craig Boldman, who is a very good friend of Carl's and mine, and was also a classmate at the Cuban School. Sidebar, when we graduated from the Cuban School, it was like after 17 of us was the graduating class in that second year. And we met at like a local little restaurant in Dover, New Jersey, and had a very minor ceremony, and everybody was given a little certificate of completion, you know, or whatever. But one of the instructors, I can't remember to this day which one it was, might have been Erwin Hasen, but somebody said, you guys aren't, because as I got, I think Jan Dersom was there, there was one woman, but you kids probably aren't going to believe this now, but a lot of these people that you're standing here with now are going to be like your best friends and some of your closest friends for the rest of your lives. And he was absolutely right about that. Anyway, so back to the story of the story. So Craig Boldman had made a trip down to the Bahamas on a thing called a barefoot cruise, where you got onto this a four-masted schooner that sailed between the Bahama Islands at night. It would drop anchor offshore of a little deserted or sparsely populated island, and then the launches would run from the ship to the shore, and they would have, you know, you could have picnic lunches on the beach, and they'd set up a volleyball thing, or you could go snorkeling around to see the tropical fish and stuff like that. And he came back from this thing, and he said, oh, this is great fun. You should go on this, Ron. We should go on it together. So the next summer, he and my first wife drove out to Ohio, met Carl. We drove down to Florida and took a little train out to the Bahamas and went on this cruise. And somewhere in there, Craig got the idea. He was writing some Superman stories for Julie Schwartz at the time. And he got this idea of doing a Superman story based in the Bahamas that could feature Captain Strong, DC's sort of Popeye stand-in. And Craig was a big fan of Popeye. And we would call it Traumas in the Bahamas. And he would write it, and I would draw it. And I don't know exactly how the idea came up with that. Well, we should get a Kubert School guy to ink it as well. And that's how Carl came into this story. So basically, we got to write and draw a story set in the Bahamas with Lois and Clark going on this same cruise that Craig and I had gone on, and an adventure happened. So Carl, do you have more to add to that?
Well, I only have a little tiny bit more to add to that. And that is that Craig had the idea for the Superman story before the cruise, because I was invited on the cruise too as a tax deduction. And I was only just beginning at DC at that point. I had inked a few stories that Craig had written for Julie Schwartz. So I did have a foot in with Julie. But I mean, I was just starting out. And so I didn't have money for a cruise. So I had to say no. But I know going on the cruise, Craig already had the idea for the Superman story.
Okay.
And he also wanted it to be colored by a Kubert person. And that was the only person that Julie vetoed for whatever reason. So, but otherwise, you know, it would have been an all Kubert story.
Yeah, it's pretty close anyway.
Yeah.
So, when, well, first of all, when you were getting the story from, I'm sorry, from
what'd you say, Craig?
Craig, yeah, I'm sorry. Was he giving you just a basic plot? Was it kind of, you know, what they call the Marvel method, or were you given specifics as to what the panel should show? You know, how if you remember, even?
I don't have specific memories of it, but I would, I'm pretty confident in saying it would have been a full script, because that's the way we mostly, we, meaning the people in my circle and the people that did work for DC at the time.
And especially the people who worked for Julie, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
Full scripts.
Julie Schwartz was a you know, old school traditional, you know, mainstream DC Comics editor, and that was the full script was the way to go at DC at the time. So yeah, I'm sure you're right about that, Carl, too, that that would have been the way to do it. Still, even with the full script, if it's done right, there's enough elasticity in the full script that the artist has plenty of room to, you know, inject their own storytelling sensibilities into it to a very good degree. So, yeah. Back in the day, it didn't make, when people would ask me, which do you prefer to work from, you know, full script or plot style? I said, it doesn't matter. If the story structure is good, then either works fine.
And how did you do full pencils? Was it, you know, how much leeway did Carl have to embellish what you did?
I'll let Carl answer that.
I mean, I just, you know, I just approach Ron's pencils the way I approach everyone's pencils. I look at them and I say, what's he trying to get across? And then I try to figure out how to get it across in ink, because sometimes that is a different approach than getting it across in pencil.
Absolutely.
So, and
yeah, I mean, that what you said is, I remember once when Dick Giordano was one of our instructors, and he said that that's the way, not all inkers feel this way, but Dick certainly did, that the inker's job is to take a look at the pencils and, just what Carl said, try to figure out what the penciler's intention is. You know, what are they going for here? And then your job as the inker is to try to bring that art as far in that direction as you can. You know, to try to, you know, be a teammate with the penciler. And sometimes that might mean making little, you know, drawing corrections, minor ones, you know, tweaking things, fine tuning things, tightening things up, that sort of stuff. But a lot of times I consider it's almost like it's translating from one art form to another. If a penciler gestures in some sort of a gray value in the background, then you as an inker, are you going to use cross-hatching? Are you going to use feathering lines to do that? Are you going to make it solid black and white for a higher contrast? Sometimes it is literally open to interpretation, and that's where the inker, you know, gets to make some really big, sometimes crucial decisions on the final look a book is going to have.
Yeah, I mean, the inker, you know, if you want to make movie comparisons, is closest, I would say, to the cinematographer, where the director is setting the vision, and then he comes up to the inker and goes, "I want this to be a spectacular sunset." And so the cinematographer or the inker has to make sure it looks like a spectacular sunset, because that's what the director wants.
Mm-hmm. Right. See, doing this show, because normally our normal format is we take old books, we give a quick synopsis of it, and then we kind of review it, the art, the story, the whole thing. And over the years, I'm amazed that I've been doing this now. I think it's for close to 14 years. Which
really?
Is just insane in my mind. But over that time, I've developed a very, very different view of inking than what I had. Honestly, I used to take inkers for granted. I'll be totally honest about that. And I used to just give the artist, or the penciler, excuse me, because you're both artists, I used to give the penciler credit or blame for what I saw on the page, if I had a strong opinion about it. And then we did a book. It was an Avengers issue. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was one of the giant sized ones. And there were a couple of panels in there that had very, very, very loose lines in it. And it was it lacked a lot of detail and it looked a little sloppy. And we were criticizing the penciler until one of the guys found a penciled page, or a copy of that page without the inks. And we looked at it and we said, you know what, that's really not so bad. The inker dropped the ball because he should have given a little bit more definition and some work to it. And now, so when we critique the books at the end, we still kind of, you know, we give grades as if it's a school project. We still give the art one overall grade, but a lot of times I find in the description of my grade, I'm saying the pencils in this were clearly very loose, but the inker really did a great job of pulling it together. Or, you know, it looks to me like the inker was a little over anxious on this and, you know, too many thick lines, and I don't like the way it looks because of that. So now, you know, at least I've come to credit or blame the inker as much as I'm doing the penciler. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like that, given that level of appreciation for it, has given me more of an appreciation when I'm reading it to look at the artwork and to kind of take in. And I'm trying to develop the same feeling for the coloring. And I'm getting some of that. And the hardest one, really, honestly, to critique is the lettering, because there are times when it makes a difference.
Oh, it makes a big difference.
But it's a little bit more subtle when it makes the difference.
Subtle is the word.
Sometimes I don't catch on to it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, it sort of makes me think of the idea that the more you study about any art form, whether it's music, you know, painting, comic books, whatever, the more you really try to break it down and analyze it and study the different aspects of it, the more you can appreciate it, but also at the same time, the more it sort of demystifies it. So you sometimes lose a little bit of that, gosh, you know, that magical, you know, sensation of being absolutely astounded by something that surprises and dazzles you. The more you're able to sort of deconstruct it and see how they came about that. That said, there are still artists or comic books that I look at, and I just, you know, it just takes my breath away. I just don't know how they did that. Mm-hmm. But most of the time I can say, okay, I see what they're going for here, and I can see the flaws in it here. I can see how they're trying to do something there. So it, whether we're doing it as a professional that creates them or somebody who, you know, does what you do, Paul, and that try to do that sort of deconstructing and evaluating and stuff, you know, the more you know about it, the better you are at that job. But sometimes it takes away a little bit of the magic of it too sometimes. But yeah, I just want to advocate for the inker again, because I've had stages in my careers where I penciled and inked my own work, stages where I penciled and was inked by others, and stages where I was the inker only. There were a few years where I was only getting work as a penciler, a couple years when I was only getting work as an inker. So I've seen it from all these different sides. And as a penciler, there have been times where I felt absolutely victimized by the inks. I'll turn in pencils that I think it's really clear what I was going for and what I'm shooting for. I think in my head it is. And then the inker does something completely different that I feel did a great disservice to the look that I was going for. And other times when an inker is really, wow, that's not what I was thinking of, but they've really leveled this up and they've sharpened it up. And they've made little fine tuning corrections and stuff that has really raised things up. So the inker is a critical part of this, but so often overlooked. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
I wanted to say two quick things. One is, I will tell you about the worst ink job I ever did in my professional life.
It was over
Marshall Rogers. DC was putting together the Heroes for Hope or Heroes for Hunger Ethiopian famine. And they gave me a chance to ink two pages penciled by Marshall Rogers. And I was, oh, wow, this is really exciting. But this is where I violated the rule of inking that I told you before. I did not look at those pencils and say, what is he trying to do and how can I get it in ink? I looked at those pencils and said, you know, I really like the bold blacks that Frank Miller is using in Dark Knight. I'm going to ink that this way. And it turned out awful. It looks horrible. And I spent years apologizing to Marshall Rogers about that job. Years.
Well, there is a time. There are times when I've inked projects, and sometimes I've there are times when I feel that my job is definitely to try to figure out what the parents are doing and follow through on that. And there are other times when I feel the assignment, either because that's what I was directed to do by the editor, or because I have a greater sense of ownership about the project for whatever reason. I figure, no, it's my job to bring as much Ron Randall to this thing as I can, for better or worse. That seems to be the assignment.
I was just going to say, one time I inked James Fry, who's a very good artist, And I enjoyed inking him, and I was applying my rule, trying to figure out what James was trying to do. And I thought I did a good job of it. And James told me later on, he goes, I wish there was more Carl Kiesel in those books.
You can't win.
See, one of the interesting combinations, or one of my favorite combinations of penciler and inker, just because it's so easy to see the difference between this artist and when he's inked by other people, is when Sal Buscema was inked by Klaus Janson. And there was few and far between. There was a few issues of the Defenders that they did together. And my experience with the two, and your experience may vary, is I always felt that Sal, who recently left us, and I think he left an incredible body of work. We did an episode where we talked about some of that. He was very, very consistent. Mm-hmm. He was not often spectacular in his pencils, but he was always, at a minimum, good. And mm-hmm. sometimes he was a little better than good. Or sometimes he was a lot better than good. But I always felt that Klaus Janson, who could tend to overpower artists on occasion, I don't know if you feel differently, it complemented Sal's work so much with the coloring and everything that I just thought those issues really popped and were beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I thought, here's a guy who is truly, you know, because I remember, you know, Stan would often credit the inker as the embellisher. And mm-hmm. I said, here's a guy who's truly embellishing the artwork that he's being handed. So it has a feel of Sal Buscema and Klaus Janson in it. It's not one overpowering the other. And it's truly a combination of the two, and I thought it was beautiful. I don't know if there's anything like that you've ever seen, or if you've seen that and have a different opinion.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about there, and it's really true, and it's there's an alchemy or whatever, and sometimes a team up, a penciler artist team up that sounds good on paper, you know, and you put them together, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't mesh up like you think mm-hmm. it's going to. And other times it works out 10 times better than you thought it would have. Right. To me, what I think of Sal's work and what I think of Klaus's work are two really different things. So I don't know who put that teamwork together, whether Sal suggested it to Klaus or Klaus volunteered, or quite likely the editor just said, let's try this, you know, because that can happen anyway. In my experience.
It could have been Klaus walked into the office and they said, Klaus, we need this inked.
We need to have, can you 5 pages by Monday, please? And they said, okay.
That could have happened.
They looked at those 5 pages and said, damn, we're getting something here that we don't see from Sal normally, but it really looks good on this book. And also, I think some of it's, you know, Sal comes from that sort of, I think, the old school of penciling, where it used to be that pencilers penciled work that was basically intended to be, to use the word that you use, Paul, embellished. The pencils weren't super tight and refined. What they were putting down in pencil, every single line that they wanted the inker to do, you know, tightly showing the feathering here or the cross-hatching there. There are some artists who, as I forget who has said once, that the pencils were so tight that all the inker really needed to do is pour ink down over the grooves of the page that the pencil had done, and the work is done there. You know, there are some pencilers who pencil basically finished work, which nowadays you could actually, you know, shoot the page and just print that out, and you'd have the finished work there. But back in the day, that's not how this work is done. You look at Jack Kirby's art or John Buscema's art, you know, art or Sal's and stuff. There's plenty of work for the inker to do to decide on line weights and textures and feathering patterns and all that sort of stuff. And I think Sal's one of those artists who they lay down the blueprint for the page, right? And then it's the inker's job to go there and, you know, sort of do some of the carpentry and all of the finishing work, you know, so an inker like Klaus, who has a very strong sensibility to his work always. He's going to come and look at that blueprint and say, "Ah, and I'm going to do my stuff on it," you know. And sometimes again, the artist, the penciler underneath, gets overpowered by that stuff. And sometimes that's what the editor wants, because if you've got an inker that will deliver a consistent book month after month, almost no matter who the penciler is, that gives a unity to that title. And a lot of times the company wants that. Same result. They don't want a new penciler to come in and inject a new personality on this thing. They want the book to look the same for the kids, the readers, month in and month out, right?
Yeah, I actually could give you a great example of that. In fact, I was thinking about this when we were talking earlier. Back in the 60s, when I started reading comics, and I was reading X-Men, and who starts drawing the X-Men? Neil Adams. And who did they have inking him? Tom Palmer. Mm-hmm. There was an issue of that Neil Adams did not draw. The issue of X-Men that introduced Sunfire, it was penciled by Don Heck. And my young eyes could not see the difference between the Don Heck issues or the Don Heck issue and the Neil Adams issues on either side. I even wrote a letter to Marvel saying, "I have long said that Neil Adams lives in Don Heck." And I'd never said that. And I didn't really know Don Heck's art at all. But I noticed it was a different name, yet the book looked the same. I'm sure the editor said, "You know, Tom, make this look as much like Neil as possible." I'm sure that was his direction. But
I've had a similar thought with, I think it's the episode, the issue after Neil left, that I think Sal did. And it's got the Neil Adams look to it. And I thought the editor had to tell him, try and ape Neil Adams as much as possible. And I do, in the back of my mind, remember hearing you, Carl, complaining that everybody's trying to be Neil Adams at some point. In other words, they weren't being themselves. And I can understand that, and it used to be more prevalent that there would be a house style. I mean, in early Marvel, it seems like everybody needed to be Jack Kirby. Then in the 70s, it was like, well, you know what, everybody needs to be John Romita. And then eventually it was, you know what, everybody could be themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I went through a big phase when I was much younger of really disliking Neil Adams, not for his artwork, but because when he came on the scene, everyone had to start drawing realistically, really realistically. And there were some great artists who could do that. But as I learned about the history of comics, I was going, oh my God, we've lost the Jack Coles. We've lost the, you know, even the Kniffs. That sort of, you know, impressionism was gone. And not that it was Neil's fault, but I really laid the blame at his feet, because his style was so revolutionary at the time. It was like a black hole everyone got sucked into. And then it's taken, you know, now we have the Darwin Cooks, we have the Bruce Timms, we have, you know, the Jim Lees. We have a lot of different styles now, and I'm really grateful for that. And it took a while to get there.
I think we get into a little bit of trouble or a little bit of creative stagnation. I'm inventing a term here. When there's too much effort to be somebody who's already existed. I've seen some of that in Batman and Daredevil in particular, where people try to be Frank Miller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Frank had his own style and he was very successful and made some great stories. But he's Frank Miller. You know, you're not. You need to be you. It doesn't mean you can't learn from him and maybe kind of take some cues and say, hey, he did this really well. Let me see if I can learn from that. But you still have to be yourself. Just to translate that to my own personal experience, I am now a semi-retired attorney. I used to handle trials. And we had an attorney at my firm who was a very experienced trial attorney. And he mentored me when I was first starting to learn how to try a case. And he would say, well, you get up in front of the jury and you tell them this, 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 and this. Mm-hmm. And the first time I tried that, I fell flat on my face because I wasn't being me. I was imitating him in front of the jury. Then I immediately learned, okay, I got to regroup and say, let me take what he's doing and adapt it to my style of speaking and my style of doing things. And now I'll be successful. And I was much more successful in doing that. And I would think it would be the same thing as an artist. If you're trying to be Neil Adams, well, you know what? Nobody's going to be Neil Adams better than Neil Adams is. But if you say, well, Neil did this and I really like that and I can try and incorporate that into my way of doing things, who knows? Maybe you can do something better than him then.
Yeah.
I don't know if that analogy sits for you, but that seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, it does. When I was younger, I think most artists, you fall in love with an artist or a couple artists, and you try to be them. You try to be the best version of them. When you're young and you're learning, the way to assimilate for me, the way to assimilate a lot of art stuff was to basically to copy it. You know, to try to be that person, and the process of maturing as an artist was getting to the point where I would try to breathe in as much of this artist as I can and have it come out of my pencil. And gradually what would happen is anything that wasn't really somehow true to me would just sort of, I would slough that off intentionally or otherwise. And the stuff that would stick, the influences that would stick would be things that somehow resonated with my own temperament, I guess, as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so I was influenced by, to my mind, some very desperate sources.
Desperate?
Desperate, the word meaning things from different
areas.
Disparate, yes.
Or maybe desperate artists. Maybe they were desperate artists who influenced you.
But you know, some artists who I would consider to be sort of like have a certain amount of elegance and restraint, mm-hmm. and classical balance to their work, like Al Raymond. And on the other hand, I was a kid growing up and I was reading slam bang 'em up superhero comics from Jack Kirby and stuff. And Joe Kubert's very sort of, you know, sort of primal sort of, you know, work that just seemed almost savage all the time to me. And I loved it all. And I went to Joe's school. So you came out of the Kubert school, there was a certain amount of Joe that was trying to get into you. and a lot of that wasn't really who I was. Wasn't really my temperament, but some of that trying to get that sense of energy and tension and, you know, release from his work is an impulse that I have, as well as trying to have that certain elegance and beauty that some of those classic illustrators have too. And it was almost like it felt like there were these two different impulses tugging at me a little bit. And so the art of maturing for me as an artist was to find a peaceful coexistence for those sort of impulses inside of me. That's the way I sort of feel about my own stuff anyway.
I'm going to bring us back to that Action Comics issue that we were talking about earlier, because I wanted to ask you both, because this is relatively early in both of your careers.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, stepping on what we were just talking about, how do you feel, each of you, that your artwork has kind of grown, or what you've learned, you know, from having like this experience to what you are now? Like what how do you approach it differently now than you did then? Because I can't imagine that, what are we looking at here, 1985? So I can't imagine that 41 years has gone by and you haven't learned a little since then.
Yep. Carl, you got mute on us, Carl.
Yeah, your mic went out. I think it may have been unplugged or something, because it doesn't say that you're muted. Now it says you're muted.
Oh, no. Oh, I think what's happened is his phone is taking over his Wi-Fi or something.
Oh, yeah, the Bluetooth probably on it.
Well, he tries to solve that. Maybe I'll see if I can tackle your... No, he's still...
Not yet, and you are muted now. It says you're muted.
Take off your mute, Carl, if you can hear. There you go. That mute is off.
Now can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome back.
Yes, we can.
This is weird. My phone was like...
While you were gone.
Yeah, while you were gone,
I was connected to my computer, and I'm going, why is my phone connected to my computer? And I turned it off, and that's what happened. Okay. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was playing with my phone because there's a noon alarm that goes off because my son gets medication at that point. And I didn't want to disturb anyone, and I must have had the wrong button. Anyways, Ron, why don't you say what you're going to say?
I'm not sure what I was going to say. So, just what have I learned as an artist between now and 1985?
and I'm really just kind of, I don't want to make this too complicated. Just as far as approach goes, like, how do you look at it differently now than what you looked at back then?
Well, honestly, I don't know, other than sort of incremental sort of refinements or things. I mean, when I came out of the, I think largely what happened was when I was at the Kubert School, from the instructors and just as much from my colleagues and classmates, it was this huge dump of information into my brain. And it took a lot of years to sort of assimilate all of that and get all of that to move from my brain down to my hand, sort of. I remember there was one time, not long after we did this, maybe it was even before we did this story, but I was working on a short backup story for Joe's Sergeant Rock book. He was the editor at the time, and he would give some of us little 3 or 4 or 5 page backup story scripts, and we would take those home, and we'd work on the thumbnails and call up Joe and say, Joe, I've got this, these thumbnails ready to show you. And then he'd go over to his house and climb the stairs up to his studio above his garage and sit down next to Joe Kubert at his table, and he would critique your thumbnails for you. It was like, you know, it was one-on-one working with Joe. Anyway, so at one point I was, and I can't remember the specifics, but at one time I took some pages that I'd been working on up to Joe for him to look at. And he would always sigh, take a breath, and stroke his beard thoughtfully. And then he would make some, give you some feedback. And it was always constructive feedback. He was never tearing you down. He was just pointing out other things for you to work on, where you could improve the storytelling, whatever. And at one point he said to me, now, Ron, I'm going to say something to you now, and this isn't going to make sense for a couple of years, but I'm just going to point out to you right now. And then he showed me something about, I don't know, how to use shading or kind of perspective to use on a shot, whatever it was. And I swear to you, a couple of years later, I'd moved back to Oregon, 3,000 miles away from the Kubert School. I'm working on a page, and all of a sudden I said, oh, no, I shouldn't do that. I should do this instead. And it was like Joe was like right behind me whispering that into my ear. So, in other words, there was an intense amount of learning that I did at the school, and it just took a while for some of that to filter down. Plus, as I said earlier, the whole thing about gradually going through the process of learning to be me as an artist, not trying to slavishly imitate another artist. And so, yeah, I can't say there was any particular aha moment where I changed art or even a series of those. It was mostly just continuing to look at some new artists and if it resonated to me, sort of, you know, try to dwell on it some and then try to almost let it subconsciously get into my head. I'm not very good at looking at art and being able to break it down analytically and say, oh, well, if I use this kind of a perspective shot in this panel at this particular situation, it's going to make a difference. Maybe I'm doing that subconsciously, but I don't have it on the conscious level as much. Anyway, long answer, but Carl, what have you got to say?
But it makes sense.
I would say in my experience, I remember very vividly when I was starting out, I would get pages that I'm inking, and there were times when I would freeze. I would look at it and go, I don't know how to ink this. I do not know how to handle this panel. And I'm going to screw this up, and I'm going to lose my job, and I'm going to have to work at Burger King. And that happened a lot. That sort of, you know, just really freezing up. And thankfully, one of the things I've got now after working for 40 years is I've solved a lot of those problems. I mean, I would obviously work on those problems and solve them sometimes better than other times. But I would figure out a solution so I could get the pages in. And over 40 years, those solutions, you get better at those solutions. Yeah. And now, I mean, I was just talking with my, you know, editor yesterday or 2 days ago about this upcoming project that I will pencil myself. And we were talking about a scene. I was very excited about the scene. And I said, I dread drawing this scene because it's going to happen in this like crowded newsroom. But I now approach it with the attitude that I can do it, as opposed to, oh, how is this going to happen?
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that attitude is very different after 40 years.
Yeah, and I'll just say that reminded me of a couple of things. One is that there were times over the course of my career, like you mentioned the Action Comics story that we did. One thing about that was Craig was good at writing a script that was fairly easily drawable. You know, he is an artist himself, and writers who are also artists tend to write scripts instinctively where they're they're not writing the artist into a corner. In other words, setting up a scene that will be very, very difficult to draw or to pull off visually. Writers who are artists sort of know how much information you should ask for in a certain panel and how much will a page be able to comfortably accommodate, how much information, how much story, and call for shots that are, you know, some of them are going to be pretty strong, good visual images, and some are just going to be, okay, the character is walking through a door into a meeting with people sitting around a table. That you can't make that. That's not a big splash pagey moment, really. But it's a drawable moment. It's just not an all-star panel. But then maybe then the next panel, Superman comes crashing through the wall, you know, to interrupt the meeting, and that's a superstar panel. But anyway, so Craig's story was solid, and so you don't have to do a whole lot more than just, you know, sort of follow the lead there. But there have been times that I've worked from stories that were awkwardly staged or written, or even where the publisher didn't want certain shots done because they didn't understand comic book storytelling really well. And so they said, you can't have a word balloon coming from that building. Nobody will know who's talking if they can't see them in the panel. Literally, I had that from a publisher who's not around any longer. We don't need to go into specifics. But the point is, so sometimes I would be working on scripts where I sort of felt like my hands were tied behind my back, where the script didn't allow for good, smooth storytelling in the standards, you know, shots of, you know, here's a close-up shot and a medium shot and an establishing shot, and you put these together and it can tell most scenes pretty clearly and interestingly. And sometimes those best options were taken off of my, out of my tray before I even got started. So I had to get creative about how to compose some of these sequences so that they would work visually. And I learned a lot from that experience. And so one of the big differences between then and now, with a lot of scripts that I work on, including my own, which I can talk about that for a second too, but when I get the script, it used to be I'd get a script and I would do my little thumbnail drawing, which was the shorthand little scribble of me just trying to plan out the basic compositions for each of the panels on that page. And I'd go through, and I might have to go through 5 or 6 or 7 and torture myself about the camera angle or the composition that's going to work for here. Oh, but then it doesn't work with the panels that come before it and after it. And by now, when I'm reading the script and I'm starting to work on my thumbnails, I think automatically in my head, I'm immediately eliminating lots of possible panels because I just know that that's not going to work really well for this situation. And that's because of years and years of experience in figuring out what shots or sequences tend to work best, at least for me and the kind of stories, my style of storytelling. So it doesn't take as much effort to come up with the layout for the page that I think is going to really serve that moment well. And to me, as I've said many times, 90% of my job is that initial little thumbnail thing, because that's where the storytelling happens. And everything else is just the carpentry of building it and using using construction or using good ink lines and that sort of stuff. So
I'm happy to say I've never seen it in either of your work, but I have seen more, and it seems to be becoming more prevalent every year. And maybe it's because you guys are a little bit more old school. You know, we are in a similar age bracket, that you're not as influenced by it. But I do see a lot of books now where they seem to sacrifice some of the storytelling in order to have a bombastic page or panel so that they could sell it and make a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
And you know, I haven't seen it. I've never seen something where I could point to where I thought either of you sacrificed storytelling. And that is one of my key criticisms in books. I want to be able to look at a book and have a general feel for where the story is going, even if I didn't read the words. Just by looking at it, kind of get an idea of the flow. And there are certain artists that they might draw beautiful images, but they don't tell a story.
Yeah, well, I think Carl would probably, you maybe heard the same thing from Joe, I think it was at the Cubit School, who said, basically when you're designing a comic page or planning on visually telling a story, it's like you're illustrating a silent movie, where the basic thrust of the story should come across completely with the visuals, and then the script, the copy, fleshes out scenes, give additional content, or tells other stuff. But the basic beats of the story should be there just purely visually. And mm-hmm. sometimes when I'm talking with young cartoonists, I say, I'm going to give you what I consider to be the most important stuff for successful storytelling. This is not necessarily good career advice, because sometimes the artist that sacrificed the story to do that big splashy page might wind up getting a plum assignment from an editor because their art is very eye-catching and attention-grabbing. And I guess more power to them, but Joe Kubert would not approve of this.
No, so, no, I think that's really what you see coming out of the Kubert School, probably to this day, yes. is that emphasis on storytelling. Mm-hmm. That is at core what the comic needs to be about, or it doesn't succeed. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, like I said, I guess maybe, for you two having come from that school of thought and that school of learning, maybe you've taken that to heart and never sacrificed the storytelling. So that's key.
I was just going to say, I have heard some complaints online where there's no complaining online, is it? But I have heard some people complaining about the lack of storytelling teaching from editors, that editors themselves don't know storytelling, and so they do not teach their freelancers storytelling. You know what I mean? Many, I don't want to say many times, but there are occasions where people come in not knowing how to tell a story, and the editor doesn't know how to tell a story. So they don't know how to, a good editor is essential, is so essential to a good comic. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we're getting
there. There are certain artists who I don't care for when they ink themselves.
Yes, I agree.
And I'll give you one of the prime examples for me. You mentioned the combination of Neil Adams and Tom Palmer. I think Neil Adams and Tom Palmer is much, much better than Neil Adams and Neil Adams.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
There are some that I just feel that having a second eye in there to look at it and give their own kind of take on it a little bit, or just adjust it a little bit, improves things.
And that's what we're talking about.
Teamwork.
Yeah, exactly. Teamwork is exactly right. And that's where often it's a good editor. That's the role of a good editor, isn't it? They can look at the pencils.
And that's what brought me to that.
Exactly. Well, who's an inker that would really complement these pencils and maybe help to, shore up some of the, every pencil has got their strengths and weaknesses, right? And maybe there's inkers that can sometimes come in and help shore up and make, and complement what the pencil does and amplify the stuff that needs to be most emphasized and, that sort of stuff. Yeah. And that's, I guess, trial and error.
But I think that's also true when you compare, when people edit their own work. I think a lot of times having a second set of eyes in there to look at them and say, well, I know this is what you're trying to get across, but it fails here, and maybe you could work on this a little bit. I think that's an important thing, as long as you have a good editor. Uh-huh. Some of them might just rubber stamp stuff, which is useless, and some of them, I hate to criticize artists whose work I love, but I always felt Jack Kirby writing Jack Kirby's art and editing Jack Kirby's art would have been better if he had somebody else. He could do the whole story, but have mm-hmm. somebody else do the copy, and have somebody else just edit it afterwards to just kind of make it a little tighter as far as the story goes. And I think that's a prime example, because Jack working with Stan was dynamite, but Jack working with Jack sometimes got a little convoluted and confusing.
Yeah. I mean, I always thought the weird way people talked in a Jack Kirby comic, I always attributed that, and this is just in my head, I always said, well, that's the New Genesis accent that, this is, the apocalypse accent. People just talk in this weird stilted way when they come from these worlds. I mean, that's obviously me just making excuses for it. But
I can criticize it. I have in the last 10 years decided I need to have every book that Jack Kirby worked on for DC when he went there and created the New Gods and all of that. And I pretty much have gotten everything that he did back then. So,
the fourth world stuff he did was just him just exploding out. The force of those books is undeniable, and the power of them, I think, more than make up for the deficiencies that are in them.
Yeah, but
I agree.
When we're talking about the editors, it kind of, in a way, it made me think of it's sort of like what we were saying earlier about the inker. And the best editors, I think, are the ones that can look at what you're trying to do and understand what you're trying to do, and then make some suggestions or guidance that gets a result that's more of what you as a creator want.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, they can point out some deficiencies. Like it happened to me on a great job where an editor was saying, okay, you've got this little scene here, and then you got a scene after that that's longer, but this little scene here is the real emotional crux of the story. So maybe if you just shorten this scene a little bit and add a little bit more to that scene. And that was an editor who was understanding what the story was really about as mm-hmm. much, if not more, than I did, or at least knew how to get that across better, you know? And that was, I needed that outside perspective.
Yeah.
I, from the very beginning, as soon as, when I was doing Trekker first, I was doing it at Dark Horse, and there was an editor there. So when I took Trekker into Kickstarter to self-publish it, I wanted an editor. I wanted that. At the very least, the editor is sort of like the safety net. and if I fall off the wire, it's going to catch me and say, no, Ron, you've lost sight of the story here, or this scene doesn't flow well, or something like that. So I'm a big believer in that.
Before, and sometimes you get to that point.
Pardon me?
Before you get to that point, when you have an idea for a story, do you bounce it off of Lynn and see what she thinks? And do you use her as a set of ears? Sounding board of sorts.
Yeah. But usually not at the initial story generation point. I feel myself, and I don't know how Carl feels about this, but at that initial point, I feel very fragile then. I feel it's very fragile. So I like to get it sort of crystallized, or at least shored up to a certain point that I can then withstand some impact on it. But the initial germ of the idea, the little inspiration or vision for it, I try to come up with that all on my own. It's in the refining of the process and shaping it, you know, getting the proportions right or whatever. That's when I use outside feedback and input.
I would agree with that, Ron. I mean, there's a lot of times, first of all, my wife, Myrna, has a really good story sense, and I've come to rely on her a lot, where I'll outline a story and she'll go, you know, that's really good, but this thing bothers me. And I'm like, yeah, you're right.
You know? Yeah.
I work in two stages, kind of similar to Ron. There's usually that initial hit of an idea, and that might be a scene or a moment or you know, a little character bit or the way the character makes an entrance. There's some moment that jumps into my head that's really powerful, and I will share that with people, you know, like, this is what's going to happen, and it's the cool moment. But then when you're trying to figure out what leads up to that, what comes off of it, then I am, like Ron said, a little more fragile, and I'm going, well, I can do it this way. No, I can do it this way. No, I can do it this way. Maybe. You know, and there I need some time to work with it, let it sit for a while, let it stew for a while. And sometimes it comes together very quickly, and sometimes it doesn't.
But when you're in that
stewing, I think sometimes thing,
when you're in that stewing,
I'm just thinking when you, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm thinking when you're planning something out, and you, like you said, Carl, you have that big moment that you think that's going to be the thing that's going to hit. Now I got to figure out what comes up to that and where that leads to. Before you want to share that with an editor or with your wife or with anybody else who's going to critique it, you want to kind of have crystallized it, to use Ron's word, enough so that if they say, well, what if you did it this way? You want to at least be able to say, well, I thought of that, and this is why I don't want to do that.
Yeah, and that
because otherwise, especially if you're fragile on it, you don't want to be like, oh, they hate what I came up with.
Yeah.
No, that happens all the time where, you know, Myrna has said, what about this? And I'm like, well, this is why we can't do that. I mean, that's just as valid. Those discussions are just as valid.
Yeah.
You know?
Usually in my experience, when somebody either would say, you know, say something about something I've drawn or something I've written, usually if it's something that catches somebody's eye, then it's something I need to look at. And like it's sometimes like, oh, I made that choice for these reasons. So I'm going to stick with it. But maybe I need to compensate for that or clarify that more or strengthen it in some way. Because if somebody's looking at it and it's tripping them up for some reason, well, then there's probably something there. Not always, but quite often it's at least it will make me go back and reexamine it and say, no, I really do want to do that anyway. You know?
Yeah. No. And that's good too. That's good too.
It's all good. Yeah.
I know when I was writing Harley Quinn, I was working with Matt Idelson, who is a very good editor, but he has a style, and I had to figure out his style in order to understand how to work with him. And his style was, I would send in a script, because he wanted full scripts, send in a script, and then he would say, I love this, but maybe Harley does this and this and this at this point in the story. And he would outline a whole scene, and or, you know, or a moment or whatever. And I'd read it, and I'd go, that doesn't feel right. But I'd say, why is he asking for this to be in there? And then I would kind of like backtrack. Well, he's asking for this because it changes this moment over here. This moment over here is actually what he's having problems with. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like where that leads. You know, for instance, you know, I know in the very first Harley story, which did have Joker in it, he suggested something that took Joker out of the story very quickly. And I was going, well, I think Joker needs to be around for some of the story, but he's right. The Joker needs to be in the story less because the Joker is such an overpowering presence. And so he didn't say that. He said, let's do this with the Joker instead. I'm going, nah. But, and so anyways, that was his style. He would constantly make suggestions. And he has told me he feels as an editor, he should offer alternatives to what the writer has offered. He feels that's part of his job. And the thing is, I would have to figure out why he was asking for that change. And once I figured out that, I would almost always agree with him. I would almost always say, yeah, he's right. That is a weakness we need to fix. My fix was very often different from what his was. Mm-hmm. But we actually
addressing the core problem. It was addressing the basic core problem.
Yeah. So anyway, so once I figured that out about him, we worked together really well.
To just kind of put it to what I used to do and, you know, trying to understand for me, you know, I'm trying to understand, you know, the whole storytelling process. And the closest I can come up with is when I would be on a trial and then we go through getting all the evidence in. And, you know, that's more of a an understandable process. You know what you have to prove, you know what you have to disprove and all of that. But when you get to the end and there's a summation, when you're getting up to explain to the jury, this is why they should find in your favor. I always felt, to put it to my own strengths, so to speak, it's the best way to do it was to kind of put it together as a story, to tell them a story so that they could follow along and understand and then come to the same conclusion, because it's, you can't argue with it. I gave you all the facts and here they are and this is what it leads to.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was best when I planned that out to sit there with my wife and kind of say, hey, these are the points I'm going to hit to the jury. I wouldn't verbatim do my summation because I found it was better to have bullet points and kind of do it off the top of my head rather, you know, so it wouldn't seem rehearsed. Mm-hmm. But this is the way I'm going to lead you to the conclusion.
Right.
And does this make sense? And there were times when she would be saying, you know, that makes sense, but you missed this point in the middle. If you, you know, to make the leap of faith from A to C, you need to stick B in there. Yeah. And that was always very helpful. And I would think that would be the same thing when you're trying to put together a story for a book. Mm-hmm. You know, that you might have the same thing where, you know, well, you know, you think, oh, this is a natural movement here. And somebody else reading it says, well, I need you to bring me there.
I think it's exactly right. And really what you're doing is you're telling a story just like we're telling a story. And I think that human beings, we're suckers for a good story that's well told. It's part of ever since we're, you know, sitting around campfires or whatever, people, if somebody could do, that's how Myths got started and stuff. You know, if you get somebody and they'll hang on your every word, you're doing the job there. But yeah, and the idea about, you know, getting somebody can point out you've got A and C, but where's the B? You know, that's really essential to make sure that the reader doesn't have to do a lot of, you want the reader to do a certain amount of connecting of dots.
Yeah.
Filling in certain gaps that you leave for them to fill in, because that pulls a person in, makes them feel like they're part of the story. They're sort of like your collaborator. Mm-hmm. But you've got to play fair with them too and give them all the information that they need to navigate their way into the story and help you along. That's easier said than done, I guess, or easy to, but that's, I think, the basic job, right?
Well, it makes total sense. Yeah. And I guess the hard part is to always be able to do that and come up with new creative ways of storytelling, because you don't want to become so formulaic that, you know, well, I've seen Ron has told me this story 20 times already. You know what I mean? You don't want that to happen.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
And again, there's sometimes when that's what an editor can help with. No, you've already done that. Sort of, you know, you're reviewing familiar ground already. And so I try to keep to, you know, take care of that myself from the very initially generating the story and the idea, the concept, and then the story outline. I want to hope that I'm not copying the shape of the previous stories that I've done. And so usually I think I'm able to do that, but there are times when I still want to have that professional pair of eyes to read it. And, you mm-hmm. know, if it's like, if I show it to my wife or friends that are friends, you know, somebody once said, as it, when an artist shows his work to people, what he wants them to say is, I love you. And when you show it to family and friends, that's what you want to hear. But when you show it to somebody who is a professional colleague, and especially if it's like a professional editor, what you want them to say is, this is how I feel about this piece of art you're showing me, or this story that you've written to me. And I think these are the good things about it. And these are the things that could be improved. And you want that, you need that, you know? And it's, you don't always get that from family and friends.
Mm-hmm. No,
what
I agree.
You want is, I love this, but if you do this, I'll love it even more. That's what you want. Because you never want, I hate this, or I don't like this.
Yeah, hopefully
this doesn't work. Response.
Yeah. I mean, it really is almost like improv comedy, right? It's almost like improv comedy where it's like, yes, and that's what you're looking for, you know?
Well, you both had experience in long-term projects. And I know, you know, it's kind of, well, as long as the creativity still comes, I'm going to keep doing this. And I think I specifically heard you say that on Impossible Jones. As long as I can keep coming up with stuff and people want to hear it, then I want to keep doing it. How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep from, you know, when we already have two giant volumes of Trekker, how do you come up with stuff that's still going to make me say, you know what, I'm going to back Ron's Kickstarter on this because it's still worth reading? And I do say that, but how do you get me to say that is the question.
Well, for me, it comes down to the concept that I had from the very beginning when I first created Trekker back in like 1986 or whatever, where I had, the concept was I wanted to tell the life of this young woman who's a bounty hunter who starts off in one place where her world is very, very constrained, very constricted. She has a very limited world that she works within, a very limited emotional world she wants to inhabit. And the series is about all that changing and expanding and growing. So by the very concept, it's a story, it's a series where each story is adding to what's gone before and taking us into new, to new terrain in one way or another. Emotional terrain for the character, expanding her world, her relationship to the people, the situation she's involved in. So I always had that baked in from the very beginning. And then also when I first thought, well, if she's a bounty hunter, she can have all kinds of adventures. And so there was a lot of variety to be had there. And then as the series has gone on, she's really not doing any bounty hunting anymore. She has evolved and she's doing different things now. So to me, there's constantly new terrain to explore. And and I've also realized that almost every one of the new Trekker volumes is in a slightly different sort of subgenre of science fiction. There's one that's like pretty much a sci-fi Western where she goes to a frontier planet and she tangles up with the the gruff sheriff of this place. And there's other ones where she's fighting a monster in sort of a, you know, a primitive sort of, you know, somebody said, oh, it's like a Predator movie or something. Like that. It's her in a tooth and claw death match against this, you know, genetically modified super soldier gone wrong. So each of the volumes almost has a different tone to it. And that gives me a lot of variety for stories to tell. I'm always challenged by how can I do this kind of story that's different than that kind of story. And hopefully it gives enough variety for the readers that each time they're getting something that's somewhat new, but also familiar and has the continuity of the series overall, that it all hangs together. That's the plan. And that's, it's kept my interest up. And, you know, as I say, you've got to keep yourself amused and entertained as a writer and as a creator, if you expect the audience to come along with it too. So I'm just trying to keep myself amused, I guess.
I think that's what most of us do. I mean, that's why I do it. I do it to entertain myself primarily.
And we're very selfish people, creators. We're just trying to, you know, amuse ourselves.
you have the advantage, the huge advantage of having a job doing something you love doing. And I don't know there's a lot of people who can say that.
No.
I have a good friend of mine that I've been friends with since high school, who's gone on to become a director, and he's directed a lot of, you know, fairly big name TV shows, True Blood and Manifest and Dexter. And he loves what he's doing. He goes into work every day and he just loves it. And now he's been teaching a class in the local college on directing and all. And I always say, there's so few people I know who just get up in the morning and say, I love what I do for a living. And I'm sure there's days when you say, I don't feel like doing this. But for the most part, I got to think, if you don't love it, you're not doing it at all. You would have found something else to do for your career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for comics, first of all, you don't get in it for the money, except for Ron's Corvettes that we talked about earlier. But I mean, if you want to draw and earn money, believe me, there's a lot of places you can earn a lot more money than in comics.
Yeah, you'd have to work hard to find a job that paid less well than comics. In the world of art, anyway.
Well, but, you know, well, like I said, in my mind, and again, I have no desire to know about your financials, but in my mind, you're both rich, because you know what? Wealth isn't always the financial bottom line. Wealth is living your best life. And I believe you guys, you know, when you can fill your career with things that you love doing, you are going a long way towards living your best life.
You know, as far as being rich, I will say, when I started going out with Myrna, my wife, one of the first things she said to me was, you have a very rich inner life, she said. that's where I'm rich.
and as, again, I for some reason, having heard interviews with Carl in the past, that some things come back to me. And I remember saying something to the effect of, there are very few people in this business who aren't at least nice people.
Well, so I think for the most part, I've met
you're doing something people. That you love. You're doing something you love with mostly nice people. How do you beat that?
Yeah, can't beat it. Can't beat it.
I agree that, you know, we tend to be a group of people that have been fortunate enough, probably worked hard enough too, and gotten, you know, but like got a lot of breaks down the way to be able to doing something you love. And yeah, you tend to be around people who are really engaged with their own lives and their own process. And I a while ago, I realized when you go to a comic convention, what you got there is a hall full of people that are there just to sort of celebrate something that they really enjoy, that brings their lives entertainment and richness. So it's a room full of pretty happy people, by and large.
Yeah.
See, I can relate, because what industry has a reputation for nicer people than attorneys? Oh, wait a minute. No, that's wrong, isn't it? Actually, surprisingly enough, I have met a lot of good attorneys and good people.
Right.
Attorneys. But reputation was not going to win. But I want to thank you guys. I don't want to keep you all day, but I've loved this conversation. I really enjoyed having a chance to talk to the two of you. It's well worth the wait. I look forward to meeting you both next month in person.
Yeah. And Heroes.
Getting a chance to spend a little time together in some form or another. But thank you guys for coming on, and thank you for making the time to be on.
Oh, my pleasure.
It was great to be with you both.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.